You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California, and our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we want to have conversations that will accompany our Tuesday night Zoom gatherings, and we hope that they form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. And on April 3rd of last year, the world was going through a moment. We shut it down, you all were sent home, and in the midst of it, we launched a podcast. And so allow me to be the 17,000th person to publicly say, I can't believe it's been a year. And it's obviously been a hard year, a year that I wish we could rewrite and have it go differently. But this podcast has been a really bright spot for me. Getting a chance to verbally process, to learn, to laugh has just been a real gift. And so thank you for listening. Thank you for encouraging us and giving us a reason to do this for a year. And so I thought it'd be fun this week to go back to that first week, that first episode, when this whole year was still ahead of us, when we were trying to figure out how to think about and respond to the coronavirus. And I was just curious to listen to it. Like, what did we sound like? What were we worried about? And how has our or my thinking about the coronavirus changed, shifted, gotten more sophisticated, or gotten more base? And it was a wild experience listening back to it. For one thing, Stanford is the man. I mean, so wise, and just my amazement in him was renewed. Like, this guy just like had material. Boom, ready to go. That was helpful and kind. He's just the model of how daily faithfulness cashes in during moments of crisis. And we opened the podcast talking about how this online version of church or college life is like a half thing. It almost looks the same, but it's not quite the same thing. And it struck me, you know, that's not too big of a deal for like a month or even a quarter. But, you know, it makes me wonder, you know, if you walk with a limp for a month to manage your pain, to get around, you might be a little slower, but you'll get to where you need to go. It'll do. And then you'll just go back to walking normally after that. But I mean, you walk with a limp for a year, and that changes your muscles, that changes your mechanics. You'll get used to walking that way, and it might be hard to relearn how to walk properly again. And it made me deeply hope that when this is all said and done, that I won't have grown too complacent in this season, that I will relearn how to walk again and go after the things that I was missing so badly at the start of this. And I hope you do too. And lastly, it really struck me how apolitical this conversation was. You know, some of the things that we talked about or said, if we said them now, they'd almost seem like a political stance, and they just weren't then. And if I'm totally honest, I think that should bum us out. It made me aware of how hard it can be to have any conversation without it reducing eventually to a right versus left talking point exchange. And I was just refreshed with how this didn't feel that way to me. And you know, fundamentally, this is a conversation not just about what to do or how to respond, but fundamentally about what's the heart posture? What is the lens through which you're seeing all of this stuff through? And that the lens you see it through is going to matter. What's the spiritual posture that you take? In the midst of a crisis, how do you continue to love your neighbor? In the midst of upheaval, how do you build resilience and hope? Or in the midst of something that just sucks, how do you respond with faith and love? And it made me want more conversations like this one in my life. And so it was a thrill to revisit it. I'm glad that I did. It's a little artifact of the pandemic. And I will say to you, even if you listened to it the first time around, you are a different person now. And that person might need to hear this too. So enjoy the podcast. Well, welcome to College Life Podcast. It is Thursday morning, 7:25 a.m., and I am Peter Nittler, one of the leaders of College Life, and I am joined this morning at a very, very good social distance of different locations on Zoom meeting with Stanford Gibson. Hello, Stanford.
Hello, Peter.
Well, here's how I'm going to start, okay? I'm going to tell you a little story, okay? When I was young, I always had a very well-stocked cereal cabinet. There was always Cinnamon Toast Crunch, Honey Bunches of Oats. There was the sugary stuff, the healthy stuff, which never got touched. And so I grew up very, very blessed. And except for when I went to my dad's house, for whatever reason, was terrible. He had Gorilla Crunch, I think was the cereal.
I didn't even know that was the thing.
I think it was like a healthy Kix, which I thought Kix was the healthy other cereal. So it was pretty bad. But I just assumed this was life. You wake up in the morning, you have your cereal, and when I went to college and started paying for things on my own, I remember going to the grocery store and just being appalled that cereal costs like $5 a box. I just couldn't imagine that my mom was spending $5 a box to have us with our cereal in the morning every single day. And so I had, I mean, a carton of eggs isn't $5. A carton of eggs will last you, you know, a week. Cereal box lasts like, what, three sittings? And steak, I think, is less per pound than cereal was at this point. So I ended up, I had this $2.50 rule that I would go into the cereal aisle, and if it wasn't $2.50 or below, I just wouldn't get it. I wouldn't mess around with that. And it was great because often there was a BOGO. There was a buy one, get one, and it, you know, you get your Raisin Bran Crunch, get two boxes, $2.50 each. Now we're paying $5 for two boxes, Honey Bunch of Oats, like I said. But sometimes there would be nothing on sale, and it was just a tragedy. And so you would be looking at the regular cereals, and you'd strike out, and then you'd realize, I have to go. If I want Honey Nut Cheerios, I have to settle for Honey Nut Scooters, the generic brand. Or if I want, you know, freaking Honey Bunch of Oats, I got to go Crunchy Honey Oats. And it's just the generic brand. And you take it home, and it's like, well, you feel good. It's like $2. It wasn't even $2.50. And you put it in the bowl, put your milk in, and it sort of tasted like the real thing. But it just wasn't the same. Everything was just a little bit off. And the reason I'm starting there is because it just feels like that's what now feels like right now. I feel like people are killing it with the online communication. I feel like people are really stepping up, especially in college life. People are joining the Slack page, and people are having video conferencing calls, and people are doing what they can do. But it sort of feels like it's the same thing. I'm seeing the same names. I'm seeing the same faces. But it just doesn't feel totally like the real thing. It feels sort of like a shadow thing. I'm just wondering, I guess, does that make sense to you? Like, it's not terrible, but it's just not real. It's just not the college life that we're used to, and it's starting to wear on me a bit. I'm ready for my old cereal, for my real non-generic brand cereal. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, my mom was ideologically opposed to any sugar cereals. So when I went to school, I browsed the unlimited new options and was very excited about my new life involving Apple Jacks, and then realized that my new life would actually involve Apple Zaps. And it's a shadow of the thing. And that is how I feel about this whole kind of digital area. You know, we did a whole series at the beginning of last quarter on loneliness and how digital platforms really aren't a complete replacement for social embodied gathering. And I think we just need to recognize that, you know, the gathering of the church is in some ways a mystical sacrament, and that just being in each other's presence is something that's important. You know, a lot of times, you know, I'll talk to students who will ask me, you know, why go to Tuesday nights? Why go to Sunday morning church when, you know, I can get all that content online. And in fact, there are celebrity preachers that, you know, not to throw, you know, Peter or myself under the bus, but just better at this, and the answer is that, you know, the thing that we're doing here isn't primarily about content. It is about the embodied gathering, that is, there's something mystical there. It's what the church used to call a sacrament. You know, certain forms of the church call this a sacrament. There is a embodiment of grace that is physical, that is in presence. So I guess I feel like if you're feeling like this seems like a shadow of the thing, if you're feeling longing for embodied presence, for just being together, you should lean into that longing. You should desire that. And it's a, you know, we're going to do our very best to provide you some. You know, top shelf content, but we also want you to kind of lean into that longing and really desire to be with other people when we are allowed to.
Yeah, and I don't think you saw the video that we disseminated to let people know what was going on for College Life, and you should see it. I was very proud of it. But one thing I said in the video, which I really believe, and I don't think I've ever believed it more than I do right now, is that in times like these, you do start to think about questions that you didn't think about before. And one of the questions that I was thinking about was, what do we do if we can't gather? And it seems like a lot of churches are just doing online services, which I think is a really good way to respond to this crisis. But I also I feel like it does communicate something. It just exactly like you were saying, it communicates that, well, actually what the church is content. And if you can get that content from home, then you basically have church. And I guess what I'm feeling right now is if we were to just do the College Life content, we don't basically have College Life. Because College Life is so inextricably linked to us being together and being embodied together and laughing together and playing together and eating lunch together and worshiping together and learning together. All of that, it's just, it, without being together, just none of it feels the same. And so, yeah, we're sort of in the Wild West of what we're trying to do here, because we're trying to do something without being able to do it. And so, yes, I guess I just want to reiterate that our goal is to do our best at that. But we're also very aware of that longing and the longing to be with each other and to be together. And even if you start to get annoyed with some of the ways that we're doing things, if you start to get annoyed with the Slack page, or you start to get annoyed with whatever it is, just not being able to see each other, that is actually a good, you're longing for a good thing. You're longing to be together. And that is not something to be disappointed by or frustrated by, but actually something to rejoice in. Like, actually, my heart longs for a good thing. And if only our hearts longed for carrots more than, you know, Cinnamon Toast Crunch, then we'd be much healthier people. And if our hearts long for time together more than time apart, that's also a good thing. And it's just interesting because I think, like I said, we've been wanting to do something like this. It's just come up in our conversations many times. But I'll tell you what, I would much rather be with students at Storer or Young Hall than I would be in my office talking with you on a webcam, even though this is a nice webcam system we got going on here. But
we've got this set up.
Yeah, we got it set up. So anyway, that's kind of where we want to start, is just that this is not ideal, but we're still going to have fun doing it, I suppose.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, Peter, when we were first talking about what to talk about in this first episode, should we call it an episode?
We totally should.
Sound right.
We totally should.
Okay, this yeah. first episode, the serialized episodic radio programming, really our conversation centered around a conversation that you had with your dad.
Yeah.
Where he posed, I think, is really the most compelling question that is on my mind, at least. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, my dad was over sort of before it got really, really bad. While we were talking, he just sort of said, like, what's the church saying about all this? And he's not a church goer. And so he wasn't sort of in the know. And it was all sort of happening really fast at that point. And I said, oh, we're closing the services. We're going to go to online services. And he's like, oh, no. I mean, like, what is the messaging behind what the church is saying? Like, what are they saying to people about this? And he's basically asking, like, how is the church pastoring its people? And what is their response? And he said, the reason I want to know is I'm sure that people could really use hope right now. And I sort of stumbled over my words. I couldn't really wrap my mind or my mouth around what it is that we were saying, because I feel like once it was coming out of my mouth, it felt a little bit flimsy, I guess. And so I started saying, well, it's a lot of, you know, don't fear, have faith kind of stuff. And again, as it was leaving my mouth, I just realized, What exactly am I saying? And he sort of saw through what I was saying. He's like, well, what does that mean? Does that mean if you're a Christian and you have God on your side, you can sort of screw it all? I'll just go to the movie theaters, go to the grocery store, don't wash my hands because I can pray and God will protect me. And what's interesting, my mom actually went to a party of like 80, it was a 90-year-old birthday party. And the woman came out and said, basically, I've prayed about this and God's going to protect us tonight. And so we can just live normally. And so that's kind of what my dad was saying, is that just what it means to have faith and not have fear? And I was like, no, it's not like that. It's just have faith that Jesus is in control. But the question is then begged, of course, if he has control, why doesn't he do something about it? And so even that felt a little bit like, gosh, it's not really a full picture. It's just, okay, yeah, have faith means just be as afraid as everyone else, but kind of at the end of the day, know that God is doing something. And I feel like in that moment, why it mattered to me was I was confronted by my own sort of confusion of how to be thinking about this as a Christian. Because I do think that being a Christian should provide hope in moments like these. But what does that hope look like? What does that faith look like? What does it mean to not have fear? And, you know, Psalm 27 has been thrown around a lot, a wonderful psalm. But in Psalm 27, I think David says, Yahweh is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Yahweh is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? And I'm sitting there like, well, I think a global pandemic might be a candidate for fear. That's an answer to that question. You know, I sort of feel like I'm sort of stuck in this dilemma. Or am I naive if I only have hope in God and don't kind of have any sort of fear? Or am I faithless if I'm giving in to fear? how should we be thinking about these things? And so that question kind of got stuck in my brain, and that's sort of where I wanted to take this first conversation with you, because it felt like this is such an important question. It's not about what should we be doing, but how should we be thinking? Because we're being told a lot of what we should be doing, and the officials are telling us that. And by the time this goes up, we might even have more information on what to be doing. But how should we be thinking about this as Christians, as people who believe that God is king and we serve him and think that he's good for us? So anyway, that's sort of where I wanted to take this conversation. And so I thought that you and I, Stanford, could both give a few ways to be thinking about this as Christians and as we go forward with this. What are some helpful, useful, good thoughts? And, you know, in, I think it's in Philippians, you know, we get told to think about whatever is true, honorable, pure, lovely, commendable. Think about these things is what we're told. And what is the true, good, honorable thing to be thinking about now? How do we navigate these waters? Should we be fearful? Should we be faithful? Is there something in between? And so what is this life like in times of corona, I think, is where we want to take this conversation.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the things that we're talking about, both like in my family and with my personal like Christian friends, is on the level of tactics. Like, what should we be doing?
Right.
But I have had some thoughts about this. And, you know, the first one is just that I feel like the Christian worldview needs space in it for chaos and social upheaval. And the reason that I feel that way is, you know, we've been planning for about a year now what we were going to do on Tuesday nights this quarter. And I've been preparing.
Yeah, for spring quarter.
Yeah, spring quarter. I've been preparing my spring quarter talks for, you know, 9 to 10 months, which will not get to happen. But because of that, you know, my spring quarter talks were going to be on the prophets and some of the themes in the prophets. So I've been reading the prophets for about a year now. And one of the things that I've noticed about the prophets is that all of those stories center around times of social upheaval. So one of the things that my teaching and my research revolve around is disaster statistics, which is, you know, a little disaster, a little bit of math, you mix those up, right? So disaster statistics are really hard. But the harder part is actually the social dimension, the psychology and sociology of disasters, because the human brain is just really bad at, you know, responding to things that happen every 50 to 100 years. Well, we call them low probability, high consequence events. We just can't really fit those in our head. And we always seem surprised when they happen. But you know who's not surprised is, you know, the Hebrew scriptures. The Hebrew scriptures basically revolve around these times of social upheaval. And I feel like the New Testament and, you know, like Psalms are really like focused on this idea of, hey, you know, bad things are going to happen to you in your life because you live in a broken world. You should get used to that and prepare for that. But I feel like the whole prophetic literature is about, oh, also, there will be times of chaos and social upheaval. And you as a movement and as a group should prepare for that. That is something that you should just kind of get used to. That's going to happen a few times in your lifetime, and it might be bad. And so like one of the famous chapters in the prophets is Isaiah 6. If you haven't read Isaiah 6 or haven't read it in a while, go check it out.
The King Uzziah.
Yeah, that's right. God appears to Isaiah and calls Isaiah to be God's spokesman for the next 30 years or so. But my favorite verse in that chapter is the first verse, because it says, in the year King Uzziah died. And the idea there is that King Uzziah was a righteous king, and it was a time of political stability and prosperity. And King Uzziah had been king for 52 years. So God calls Isaiah and starts that whole story the year King Uzziah died, which is the beginning of social upheaval. And in Uzziah's whole peaceful reign of 52 years, we actually only have one other prophet, and that's the prophet Amos, that happens when there's a massive earthquake that leads to social upheaval. And the most of the prophetic literature is around like the rise of Assyria and the rise of Babylon, these huge regional existential threats. You know, Joel is about the locusts coming in and wiping out the crops. Even in the New Testament, you know, the book of Revelation, a lot of that language that seems really wild is about the eruption of Vesuvius and the growing Parthian horde is what they called it. It's this huge army that was growing on the boundaries of the Roman Empire. Social upheaval is just something that happens throughout the scriptures, and the scriptures are kind of disproportionately written around these times in order to call God's people to faithfulness and hope in these periods.
That's interesting. So you're saying essentially that this idea of social upheaval is not foreign to the scriptures, that even though it might feel like, holy smokes, like, where is God during this time? Like, why isn't God moving? It's like, actually, well, if you look at the scriptures, this isn't a new idea, is to have something that's sort of confusing and big and scary out there.
And I think one of the ideas is that control is an illusion. You know, we go through much of our lives with a sense of control. And I think the scriptures warn us that, hey, that's an illusion. Control, social stability, even civilization itself are a gift of grace. We are not as critters inclined towards those things. They are a grace. And when some of that is lifted a little bit and the illusion of control breaks down a little bit, people are surprised. And I think that one of the things the scriptures want us to do is not be surprised, that this is part of the deal. We are not cosmically promised social stability or control. And one of the things that I keep thinking about as I read the prophets, which again are all of these crisis moments in time. And incidentally, you know, the scriptures talk a lot about how God is like asymmetrically patient. Like God is mostly patient. And eventually God says, you know, we have to do something here. And there's some sort of crisis. And the scriptures talk about that asymmetry of God's patience, but then we see a lot of God dealing with people in these crisis points. It's a selection bias, is that mainly we are seeing the stories of God dealing with people. We're not seeing the 52 years of God's patience or the 180 years of God's patience. But one of the things that I keep thinking about when I see these crisis points in scriptures and even now is that my favorite passage from The Lord of the Rings. You know, The Lord of the Rings is essentially prophetic literature. You know, Tolkien was a Christian and he fought in the trenches in World War I and he saw the looming specter of World War II coming, which is, you know, one of the great crisis points of the last century.
Is this true or are you making this up? Is this your read?
Well, this is my read, but I don't think it's controversial.
It's nice. I like it. Keep going.
You know, basically, Lord of the Rings is about being faithful in a time between two great wars. So you have basically the premise of the Lord of the Rings is this question that Frodo asks Gandalf. You know, Frodo says, you know, I wish this didn't have to happen in my time. And Gandalf says, and so do I, and so do all who live to see such a time. But it's not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that's given us. And I think that's the message of the prophets. I think that's the message of the Hebrew scriptures. I think that's the message of the New Testament, that you will be dealt a time and you don't have control over what time you're dealt. It could be the reign of Uzziah, it could be the Babylonian Empire taking over the ancient Near East, and you are called to hope and faithfulness. That's the biblical message, is hope and faithfulness, even though you're not really promised security or control.
Yeah, it's interesting listening to you because I feel like I don't know if it's, you know, the fact that I do this kind of thing for a living and I like the idea of coming up against truth and just noticing it and hopefully obeying it. But as I was listening to you, I was wondering, okay, so you're saying we have no control. You're saying that these types of things happen. These are not surprises to God. These are not surprises to the scriptures. And I'm wondering, is this good news in any way, or is this just news? You know, I'm thinking about all the people that are suffering in the community right now. You think about the senior year where you're expecting your spring quarter senior year to be a certain way, and this is the opposite of what that would be. Or the people who are, I don't know, if people need to take anatomy right now, and now they can't in the same way, or freshman year, such a unique year, just gets cut short, or, you know, people with family lives, which aren't great, and now they're at home wondering, how am I going to navigate this tension with my parents? And so it's just, I hope this isn't putting you on the spot, but it's just the, what you just said feels true to me. It feels like this is what the scriptures say. And I guess I'm wondering, is that just news? Meaning, is it just true, or is it also good news?
Well, I don't know if it's, you know, my scientific training or my theological training, but I'm primarily interested in what's real. And so in some ways, it's just news. The disaster statistics and the Hebrew scriptures kind of tell the same story, that we need to be prepared not only for personal tragedy, which happens to Ezekiel, he loses his wife, but also for being a minor player in a social upheaval that's much bigger than ourselves, which it happens to Ezekiel as well. But then there's also the promise of restoration. You know, all of the prophets have a promise of restoration, that God's movement and God's people will last beyond any social upheaval, that maybe governments won't, but God's people will. And then the other thing that Ezekiel turns on is that beautiful passage of the Valley of Dry Bones, where he kind of looks beyond the hope of restoration to the hope of resurrection, that fundamentally our final hope can't be in this world, because all of our stories have sad endings. There's no human story that doesn't have a melancholy ending. There's a lot of hope in restoration in this life and in this world, but like the final hope is, do we really believe in the resurrection? Do we really believe that, you know, we're going to live with a lot of joy and a lot of pain in this world? This world is a mix of, you know, trouble and unbelievable beauty. But at some point, the true hope is in beauty beyond this world.
Well, I wonder if, you know, I think about my life, if I've just seen a disproportionate amount of beauty and haven't had big moments like this to feel the truth of this world being chaotically bad. I think a lot of the bad that I've experienced, whether it's my parents getting divorced or insecurity or whatever it might be, you know, it feels like a small scale bad that many people have to go through, but doesn't necessarily derail all of life. And right now we're going through something that feels like, well, this doesn't seem fair, maybe. This doesn't seem like it has a point. And what would possibly be the silver lining?
I think it's important that not everything has a silver lining. You know, I think the message of the scriptures is that we live in a beautiful and broken world. And those things aren't always connected. Sometimes things are just broken, and sometimes they're just beautiful, and often they're both. And I think that the main thing that, you know, as you walk through the decades of your Christian life, that you want to do with situations like this, and this won't be the last one, is that you need to train the muscles of resilience and lament. You know, you can get derailed by something like this, or they can build the muscles of resilience in you. But also, you know, we talk a lot about joy and about living a life and building practices that build joy in your life. But there's also an appropriate response of lament. You know, I am mourning the senior years or the freshman years. It is appropriate to mourn. If you are feeling sad, that is appropriate. You know, there's a whole, the book of Jeremiah is followed by a book that is, no kidding, called Lamentations. Like, he was not happy about the situation, and he shouldn't have been. It would have been inappropriate for him to be celebrating. Lament is appropriate, but also while you lament, build those muscles of resilience so that you can push through to a season of joy.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember before we had Mason, I remember thinking, I'm just excited for whenever my child has any genuine emotion. Mm. I just want him to feel genuine joy, genuine happiness. I think seeing genuine sadness and genuine fear is a beautiful thing in a way. And it's why I like watching weird sort of dark movies sometimes or sad movies, because I like feeling the authentic emotion. It sort of makes me feel human. So, you know, I like that idea of just that a healthy response to all this might just be being sad, might just be being frustrated, and building how to do that well, or how to just do that. All right, here's one thing that I've been thinking about as we've been kind of walking through the times of Corona as well. You know, there's this idea in the scriptures and this idea in Christian culture, I feel like, and I don't even know if this actual phrase is in the scriptures, but it feels like it is, of just like, put your anxieties on Jesus. I think in 1 Peter, it says, cast all your anxieties on God because he cares for you. And the thing that I've been thinking about is I sort of get this in a theological sense. Like, I get the image of a father and son, that a child, you know, gives their anxieties to their father with complete abandon, and the father's glad to take them. Why wouldn't we then give our anxieties to God? And, you know, I get that in the theological sense, but in the practical sense, it doesn't make as much sense to me. And I guess I'll try to tell you why, but like, it makes sense to me right now for Mason to cast his anxieties onto Katie and me. He doesn't actually handle any of his own anxieties. He'll have any sort of anxiety, whether he's hungry or whether he's tired, and he will never think I'm going to deal with this on my own. He will just, he'll just cry.
I got this one, Dad. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. You guys stay there. I'll put myself to sleep. Yeah. What he does is he'll cry and he'll expect us to do something. We will do it for him. We will feed him, or we will change him, or we will put him to sleep. But, you know, for a student who's anxious about a test, it doesn't work the same way. It's not like, okay, I just cry out to God and then he takes the test for me. You know, it's not the same thing. Like, we do everything for him, all of his anxieties, but God doesn't do everything for us. So what does it actually practically mean to cast our anxieties on God because he cares for us? So again, it sort of just feels like it's a nice sentiment. And I like the idea of being able to say that to people when they're going through trouble. And I just hope they never ask me, well, okay, how do you do that? What does that mean? Because I often don't know the answer to that question.
So Peter, how do you do that? What does that mean?
The answer, I feel like this season has actually given me an answer to that more than I've felt before, because I've talked to a lot of people, whether my family or friends or in this community, who are just really, really anxious about this, and almost not even necessarily about their own life, but just anxious about the news, anxious about coronavirus creeping in and being really, really bad. But what's interesting about this particular crisis is that it does produce a lot of anxieties, but there's really not a lot to do. It feels like the best thing to do is to stay at home and to not be out and to live your life differently for a season so that we can calm this thing down.
I think that's the thing that I'm having the most trouble with, is that I respond to anxiety by doing something that will make some sort of difference, even if it's mostly a placebo effect. Like, action is my therapy.
Right. And that makes sense, because we want to feel useful. We want to feel like we're doing something productive to make it out of this thing, or at least just to calm our own hearts.
Right. But we're just not in that space right now.
We are
adrift with our own helplessness.
Yeah. Like, what we can do that's helpful is to not do anything. And so what's interesting is that once you're following everything that you're supposed to be doing, like, there's an appropriate fear and an appropriate anxiety that just gets you into the house. You know, if you had no anxieties, then you would just be living life carelessly, which it would be foolish, would be unwise. But once you're sort of doing that, then what you can do, your sort of sphere of influence is reached. You've maximized it, essentially. And so the extra worrying, the extra anxiousness that you feel beyond that is sort of useless. And I understand that it's easy and it's tempting and there's lots that you can read to make you feel anxious, but I've never felt the cast your anxieties on God because he cares for you so acutely, because it feels like, actually, what I can do in this season is I can stay home. And then beyond that, I can't do much else. So all the anxiousness I'm feeling is just robbing me of joy. Mm-hmm. Like, coronavirus is not doing that to me. It's just my anxiety is doing that to me. And so you do think, well, what I could do is I could pray. I could actually sit here and feel, wow, I'm very nervous for the world right now. And instead of feeling that nervousness and putting it all on my heart and on my chest, what I could do is I could pray to God. And that might not actually cure my anxiety, but it is doing something. And it also might cure my anxiety. And so you could ask God to move. You could ask God to do something, to tell him that you're anxious, and letting him father you, letting him come to your rescue, even in a small scale way, and just calming your heart and letting him pick you up and encourage you. And what's interesting is that I've just never felt the practicality of casting your anxieties on Jesus in the same way that I'm feeling right now. And again, you sort of hear this stuff all over the place in the Bible. Jesus talks about this. He's like, the flowers get clothed, the birds get clothed. Remember what he says? And so, you know, you have no reason to be worried. You have no reason to be anxious about tomorrow. Let tomorrow worry about itself. And, you know, in Philippians, do not be anxious about anything, but by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And so there's all these things that feel so just like nice ideas most of the time. Because it feels like, well, I have to handle my anxieties. I get that I'm supposed to give them to you, God, but at the end of the day, I have to take the test. I have to do the thing. And right now, at the end of the day, we have to stay home and hope and pray that this thing gets better. So what do you think about that? Does that make sense? It feels sort of elementary of just, oh, finally, I'm getting this lesson that I feel like I should have learned in Sunday school.
In some ways, you need space to learn that, right? Because if there's something you can do to mitigate your anxiety, then prayer, at least for me, I'm not, you know, of the spiritual disciplines, prayer is the one that I suck at. And so if there is anything else I can do to feel useful or manage my anxieties, and part of it's just, I grew up in an immigrant family, you know, everything is about what you do, what you produce. And the idea that you would manage your anxieties by simply turning to God is almost seems too simple, but we have the space to explore that insight. And I think it's really powerful. And I also think that like there's kind of a negative side of that as well. It's like, well, what do you do with your anxiety? You know, when you're feeling nervous, do you open up a news source? You know, and I think there's kind of a flip side of turning to God is not habitually turning to something that will heighten the anxiety. And so that, you know, right. I think there's a practice that would go with that, that would be kind of right sizing your information appetite. So that instead of turning with anxiety to another news source, that's not going to give you more actionable information, but rather turning to God with your anxiety, I think that you could almost do a habit swap there and be in a healthier space.
Yeah, it's interesting. Often when I talk to students about their spiritual habits and their spiritual rhythms, we talk about the first thing you do in the morning or the last thing you do at night. And I would be a terrible example of that right now. Like right now, the first thing that I did it this morning, is I open the New York Times app and I sort of half read it. You know, I just kind of want to see the new numbers and then I might pray, which is still, you know, it's good to pray. But it feels like, yeah, my first instinct right now is to look at the news, look at the updates and see what's going on.
I do not. I definitely do my run and do my devotional time. And then I open up the New York Times summary. I read the headlines. I look at John Hopkins' epidemiological app. And then I intentionally do not ingest more news on coronavirus until the end of my workday.
So you think you're better than me? That's what you're telling me. You think you're better than me?
I am suggesting that that might be a healthier practice.
That sounds much healthier. I wish.
And then my wife is up. My wife's a health professional, and so you know, once my workday is over, then I re-engage. But in the time that I'm trying to be spiritually sensitive or productive, I have limited my informational intake, and I do think that your practice of, you know, when we're feeling anxiety, there is a habitual response to click on some sort of informational source, but it's not going to ease the anxiety. Maybe we hope that there's going to be some good news. And, you know, that's just not how the exponential curve works right now. And so maybe limiting the intake so that it's wise, so that we understand what's going on, but that it's not the narrative that's dominating our day would be healthy.
Yeah. And I wonder if what might be a good practice to sort of try to fill a habitual response towards praying about these things is just to come up with one sentence or two that you could pray to God whenever you're starting to feel an anxiety creep of just feeling, saying, Father, I'm feeling anxious right now, or Father, I'm scared. The world is hurting. Would you please do something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've talked about this before, but I just find it impossible to come up with words to say to God. I feel unqualified. I realize that's theologically bankrupt, but it's just how I feel. It's just like, I'm not good at this. And so that's why I found the Psalms so useful. And so a lot of times I read the Psalms until I find a passage that I can essentially offer to God in repetition until I believe it. So I have another one that I've been thinking about as well. And it's really a direct response to your dad's question and the idea of, you know, the prayer protected dinner party. And I was thinking about, like, you know, what are kind of the most famous verses? And I think you can tell what the most famous verses are. Are they hidden somewhere on some sort of In-N-Out packaging? Right, like John 3:16. If you didn't know this, most people know this, but if you didn't know this, if you look on the inside bottom of the soda cup, John 3:16 is right there. But
I think that Nahum is on the milkshake.
No,
which is the only time anyone's opened Nahum.
No, the milkshake, and I know this because I get the milkshake, is Proverbs 3:5. And what's Proverbs 3:5? Well, Proverbs 3:5 says, trust in Yahweh with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all of your ways, acknowledge him and he will make your path straight. Be not wise in your own eyes. Okay, so I drifted into some other verses there. But there's this sense that trust is at odds with understanding, right? And that we are people of faith, not of analytical analysis. And so that maybe we should have an entirely different approach to this than we're seeing in the world and in the media. And, you know, maybe we are exempt, or maybe like our whole decision process is somehow trust versus understanding. But I think that there's a really important clause in this verse that gets ignored. It doesn't say trust not in understanding. It says trust not in your understanding. It's calling for self-skepticism. And it would be thematically weird if this passage didn't ask us to think carefully about the world, because it's in 8 chapters in the beginning of Proverbs that are primarily about wisdom. Like, let me read you some verses that come before it and after it. Chapter 2, verse 9 says, "Then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity in every good path, for wisdom will come into your heart and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul." And then in chapter 3:13, it says, "Blessed is the one who finds wisdom, the one who gets understanding, for the gain from her is better than silver, and the profit is better than gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you can desire can compare to wisdom."
Wow.
And so there is this sense that, like, the Christian way to approach anything confusing is trust and wisdom. And so I had a friend in college. He was actually considering whether or not he wanted to become a Christian. And as part of that process, and one of the conversations we had, he said, "You know, I feel like the Christians I know, when they say, you know, when I say, that's interesting, I would think about that. They say, you know, I want to pray about that." It's almost like they were offloading the analysis to a central computer. They didn't want to do any of the work of analysis themselves. And I think it's actually good news that we approach these questions not really like the world does, but also not unlike the world does. Like, disaster statistics matter. You know, the way that we approach this is to take in good information, process it, be a little self-skeptical about what we believe from the beginning, and try to make the best possible choice. But in that, to trust Yahweh with all your heart, to put your trust in God's goodness and love.
Yeah, so that does feel like a balance between this fear and faith that we sort of started with at the beginning. You know, are we totally faithless if we are living in fear? And we might think, oh, living in fear means doing anything that those who don't have the hope of Jesus do, like think about statistics, worry about the exponential curve, take seriously the advice of the medical professionals, or this idea of hope and, yeah, just the balance between the two of these things. And you're saying that the way that you sort of hold on to both these things, or at least be in the middle, is to trust Yahweh and also to do your best to gain wisdom.
And I think that, I mean, I remember a few years ago, our ministry was in relationship with, you know, a couple of the, you know, campus leaders in the campus atheist program. And they, I remember at one point, one of them said, you know, Christians just don't think. They just don't think. I don't respect Christians because they just don't think. And their scriptures don't encourage them to think. And I thought, I'm not sure you've read our scriptures. There is nothing that you can desire that compares to wisdom.
Wow.
Understanding reality is an important pursuit for a Christian. And so I am very interested in what epidemiologists are saying. And I trust not in my own epidemiological understanding, but will kind of submit to their expertise, also knowing that experts can be wrong. And in realms where God actually has wisdom that is offered distinctly, that I'll go with what God says.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. In just the idea of sort of trusting what God says has been another thing that's been on my mind a little bit. And it's another very simple and sort of an idea that you learn in Sunday school kind of idea. But with the new realities of this virus, it just sort of has come into a little sharper focus for me. And it's pretty simply just this idea of loving your neighbor. And here's kind of what I mean by that, I guess, that the idea of what life in the kingdom looks like, and if you were to read any part of the scriptures, but if you were to read about how God expects us to be with each other, it is decidedly not, you know, you look after yourself and your family only, and then sort of everyone else just has to figure it out on their own. That it's, we are much more interconnected than we have maybe been trained to think just growing up in sort of the West. And sometimes it can be pretty hard to know, okay, well, what does it mean to love my neighbor? What does it mean to live this interconnected life? But it feels like one thing it means is that you acknowledge the reality that my life is not just connected to me. My life is connected to other people. What I do, how I live my life matters for the way other people live their life. And that's just true. That's just a reality. And what's interesting now is that because this thing doesn't affect this age group in the same way it affects, you know, the older group or the more immunocompromised, you can sort of think, well, this is just the flu. It's not going to affect me that badly. So, you know, sort of who cares if I get it? And that's a pejorative way to think about what people are thinking. But they're just thinking, well, we're probably going to get it anyway. So it doesn't necessarily matter how I live now because, you know, I'm going to get it and it's not going to be that bad for me. I might not even have any symptoms. But, you know, just thinking like that presupposes a way of thinking about how we relate to people. It presupposes the most important thing is what happens to me and not about what happens to my neighbors. And obviously, that's a very easy way to think, but that's not the thinking that the scriptures are trying to get us to think. And, you know, one of my favorite verses and one of the things that is sort of the cornerstone of our leadership team at College Life, the 12, is this verse, very famous in Philippians 2, that just says, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his or her own interests, but also to the interests of others. And, you know, it's very easy for me to think about that when I'm thinking about my own grandma. When I'm thinking about, well, I don't want to visit my grandma because I love her and I don't want her to get the virus that I unknowingly have because it might not affect me. But if I think about, well, if I go to the grocery store and I'm careless, or if I just sort of think, well, it's not going to affect me, so it's not that big of a deal, then I am actually doing much from selfish ambition or conceit. And not in humility, I am not counting others more significant than myself. I am counting myself more significant than others. And I'm looking to my own interests and not to the interests of others. And just the invitation in the scriptures is to do something so different. And again, it's sort of the same thing I was talking about before, but you can actually love your neighbor by saying, hey, I don't want to be near you because I don't want to hurt you right now. I will actually say no to some things in my life, whether that's, you know, going to the store as often as I want, or, you know, Katie and I love to get ice cream. And it's just like, well, it's just not the time. It's not the time to go out to Baskin Robbins with our little infant son who could just be a carrier of this thing and go get ice cream. It's just not the time. We will say no to that. And honestly, that feels hard to do. It's not insignificant. Anyway, it's just this interesting idea that the life of faith is not one where you just look after yourself.
I think that's one of the really interesting things about the Christian ethic, though, is that it finds different embodiments in different moments, right? Because what it meant to love my neighbor 1 month ago is really very different than what it means to love my neighbor right now. One of the reasons I think that Christianity is true is that it has the right balance of rigidity and flexibility. Like, there are things that are fundamental. Loving your neighbor is a fundamental core principle of the universe. Yet, it's flexible. How it instantiates in a certain moment is radically different and requires wisdom, right? The reason that wisdom is such an important biblical concept is because loving your neighbor does not look the same way in our day as it did in my parents' day or in Abraham's day or in Jesus' day. And it doesn't look the same way as it did like 15 days ago either.
I think the thing that I feel, and again, I like your language in this time of things that it's healthy to lament. Not that this thing is good because it teaches us to lament, but it's healthy to get to experience lament. And I feel like it's healthy to put in such stark contrast my propensity to think just of myself and ignore my neighbor. Because when I'm just going about my normal day, I can sort of convince myself that I'm loving my neighbor when I'm really not thinking much of them.
Right.
And it's healthy for me to see that contrast in such stark colors of actually my default is to just think, how does this affect me before I think about how does this affect my friends or my friends' grandmas, you know?
Right.
And so I feel sort of thankful for that in a certain way. And it was interesting. I was talking with Neil Redenbaugh, the FBC's youth pastor, and he was saying that, you know what, a big tragedy of this whole experience would be is if we went back to living the exact same way we were living before, you know, because right now we do have maybe a longing to be together, or like I'm saying, I'm having an experience where I'm seeing more clearly how to cast my anxieties on Jesus or how to think about loving my neighbor or even actually loving my neighbor. And what would be a tragedy is to then go back to the way things were and lose those insights. And just like you said, it's going to look different. But I hope I don't lose that ability to see that, yeah, actually, I am living for myself in a way that I didn't think I was before. Or at least the default position of my mind is, first and foremost, I'm going to think about my own health and my own safety before other people's.
That's good. And yeah, and we've talked about this. You and I personally have talked about this, but I would never suggest that this is in any way good. You know, what we're experiencing now is bad. It is a symptom of the brokenness of the universe and the world, and a mixture of the brokenness of the natural world and the social world. There's nothing good. I will not call what is evil good. What we're talking about is, how do we continue to grow and press into this time and use it to get a better sense of what's real and who we are in the realm of what's real, and connect with God in new ways, even better ways? How do we stay spiritually healthy? But also, I like that you're actually turning us outside. You know, part of spiritual health is not being completely obsessed with ourselves and how we're experiencing this.
Yeah, so here is sort of to hope in and pray in that in this sort of tragedy, in the evil that we're experiencing now, that we would see things about ourselves and learn things about ourselves that we can take into periods of health, and that these things would not be wasted. That is a hope that I have. I also have a hope, Stanford, that this podcast wouldn't just be a place to discuss big, big, big ideas or heavy topics, that we would have some fun doing this as well. And so we are going to end the podcast every time, and we are approaching the end with something that we're going to call Quarantine Corner. Okay, here's the idea. Okay, quarantine is weird. We have different pockets of time on our hands that we didn't used to have before. We're trying to fill it with things. Maybe we're learning how to play guitar. Maybe we're learning how to play piano. Maybe we're, I don't know, trying to start a podcast. All sorts of different things. And so every week, what I want us to do is to give a little recommendation. Tell us how you're getting through quarantine time, and then turn it into a recommendation for us of what we should be doing. It could be something to read, something to listen to, watch, think about, do in quarantine time. So we are entering Quarantine Corner. Stanford, what is your Quarantine Corner?
So the thing that I'm doing in quarantine that maybe is least applicable to our college students is I am homeschooling. We've been curious about homeschooling for a long time. Yeah. And we have suddenly gotten the opportunity to try it, even though both Amanda and I have to put in full work days during the day. It has actually been delightful, because I've always had this vision of what I would want to do with homeschooling. I'd want to like cover the core curriculum. You know, my kids need to do math. They need to do a lot of math. They need to learn to write and read. They really need to learn to write.
Yeah.
You know, in a homeschool day, you actually have spare time that you're not using disciplining Johnny.
Right.
So, you know, what I've always wanted to do is a kind of ancient future homeschool where my kids would get some time to actually interact with the scriptures and ancient literature and ancient philosophy, and also learn to code.
Yeah, right.
My kids need to learn to code. And so that's what they're doing. They're all learning to code, and they've all like developed these devotional projects. We gave them kind of menu of things that they could try to start a devotional life. They've taken on these devotional projects. And one of them, Alethea, my middle child, has chosen this journaling Bible version of Mark. And if you just go to Amazon and say ESV Scripture Journal Mark or ESV Scriptural Journal Psalms, it's just a pretty cheap biblical version where it has all the text on one page and then an open lined page on the flip side. And you know what Alethea is doing is she's just going through, and sometimes she's drawing, sometimes she's writing, sometimes she's writing about the passage, sometimes she's just writing about how she's feeling. And I feel like this could be a really good way to invite you into a devotional practice that probably should be part of a healthy rhythm while you're isolated from your friends, and also maybe a healthy rhythm for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But also, I think this is going to be an amazing document for her to have when she is 35. You know, that was my quarantine corona journal with all these little pictures I drew. And so I think that I don't think it's just for 12-year-olds. I think it would be a really amazing way to integrate some devotional practices into your life as a college student.
That's actually brilliant, because one day you're going to have kids or grandkids, and they're going to be reading about this time in their Houghton Mifflin or whatever the textbook company, McGraw-Hill.
Yeah, right.
They're like, we're reading about the coronavirus times, and they're going to ask, what was it like? We're going to think, oh, it's weird. But if you have actual stuff that you wrote during the time and you misspelled words and whatever it is, that's right. Going to be an awesome
doctor. Right. And she misspells more words than she spells correctly, because she is, in fact, my daughter.
I was going to say, I don't know if you want to out yourself as one of the worst spellers I've ever encountered in my life.
Worst spellers in the history of spelling. Yeah. All right, how about you?
Okay, yeah. So my quarantine corner is, it's going to be attached to a little story, so just bear with me. But my quarantine corner, so what I recommend, is anything on Netflix that is not The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Okay. I didn't realize that's how this was going
to
go.
Yeah, this could go any way we want it to go. We have a lot of freedom.
Yeah, this is a not quarantine corner.
So let me tell you what's going on. So Katie and I, before this coronavirus thing happened, we decided to give up watching TV or movies or anything for Lent. And so this is a heck of a time to not be able to watch anything on a screen. It's really, really quite something. But we knew that on Sundays, at least in some traditions, you can break the fast of Lent. And so this last Sunday, we had just driven back from Mammoth. So it had been a couple hours with Mason in the car. We were just like so exhausted. It's like, let's just watch something. We can break Lent tonight, so let's do it. And so Katie just said, when I was kind of doing the endless scrolling of Netflix of just what to watch, which is just could take a whole 2 hours in and of itself. It's just picking what to watch. But she said to me, just pick something that we can bank on being good and fun and light and that I'm going to have fun watching. And I knew, I'd heard that this is the 20th anniversary of The Talented Mr. Ripley. And so I've heard a lot about it recently. And it had Matt Damon, who's just always a good guy.
Safe bet.
Matt Damon's as safe a bet as possible.
Yeah.
And when I read the synopsis, what I read, this was not what it said, but what I read was that this is about a con man who sort of cons his way into the wealthy echelon and just kind of wants to stay there. And what it actually said was this is about a sociopath who cons his way into the upper echelon and will do anything in his power to stay there, which includes sorry to spoil it, murders, and it's terrifying and creepy. And Katie told me, like I said, just do anything that's just going to be fun and light. I was expecting sort of a con man and Matt Damon. So like maybe he's going to be smart. Maybe it's like Good Will Hunting and he's kind of conning people. Maybe this will be like Catch Me If You Can. Like those are both.
Yeah, like maybe The Martian too. Yeah. Like outrageous talent. But it turns out his talent is maybe not that enjoyable.
Not that enjoyable, no. And, you know, Jude Law is in it, Gwyneth Paltrow, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Oh. It's got, like, such a good cast. Like, this is a home run. And Katie was, like, under her blanket, like, unable to even watch, and just said, like, the one thing I asked. the one thing I asked was that this would just be fun. And so it was just not what I expected at all. But that being said, I've been thinking about it a lot since we watched it, and I think it was a pretty good movie. But all I'm going to say is that if you're going to want to watch something that's light and fun, go with National Treasure. I think that's on Netflix. But just anything but The Talented Mr. Ripley. Okay, that is my quarantine corner for this week.
We very rarely get to watch a whole movie before sleep takes us. So we'll make sure to avoid The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't think it'd be
until we're ready for something darker.
Yeah, right. And okay, so that is it. That's it for the first ever podcast. Like I said, this is currently without a name, but maybe by the time we get it up, it'll have a name. And also, I think I want to hear just questions from you guys too, and questions in multiple forms. So again, this has been on the Google form, but if now just listening to this, you're realizing, okay, this is what it's going to look like. Here might be some fun questions. Would love for you to email me or direct message me any questions that you have. And also, Stanford doesn't know this, but I would think it'd be cool if, you know, Stanford is sort of in and out of our community. And so, you know, you get to see him at a lunch bunch, or you get to see him on a Sunday morning, or you get to see him on a Tuesday night when he preaches, but you don't always get a long conversation with him. And so you might be wondering, or you might have some questions that's like, I've always wanted to ask Stanford X. And so I think we might have an episode that's just Ask Stanford Anything, and would be great to have some questions for you some questions from you to him of just anything you want to ask him or anything you want to ask me or Miriam. And it could be fun questions, could be theological questions, but it'd be fun to just get your input. And so go ahead and email me those. And I think that is it. So Stanford, anything else you want to add? Anything you need to plug?
The The Book of Mark.
The Book of Mark. Okay, that's good. And maybe your dissertation. Can we get our hands on that?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. I just published an excellent paper on using dendrochronology to date ice jam disasters.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's thrilling.
Okay, well, maybe I'll read that and then sleep will get me.
Yeah,
that's over. All right, that's it for this little blast from the past. And next week, we are moving back into the future. Christian Wingate and I will be opening Paul's letter to the Corinthians. And then throughout this quarter, you'll be hearing from some of our student speakers who have been preparing talks on Corinthians all last quarter with our preaching class. And they've put a ton of work into their talks. And I think they're going to have a lot of great stuff to say. So I think you're going to love hearing from them. But we also want to put the feelers out again and to field your questions for another Ode to the Question Mark Q&A type episode coming this quarter. So if you have any questions about faith or life or the scriptures or anything else for Stanford or for me, please head to collegelifedavis.com/questions and let us know what you got for us. And thanks as always to Kyle Jung and Josh Paskey for the music of Your Pod and Your Staff. And if you want to hear more from Josh Paskey, he actually just released a single that you can find on Spotify. It's called Rose Colored Glasses by Paskey, P-A-A-S-K-E, and it's great. But before we go, I want you to know, College Life, that we love you more than Stanford Gibson thinks he's better than me. We'll see you next week.